Welcome to the Math Ed Podcast. My name is Sam Otten from the University of Missouri, and joining me today is my friend Jeff Chopin, who's from the Warner School of Education at the University of Rochester. He's a professor of teaching and curriculum. Jeff, it's great to talk to you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Sam.
So Jeff and some colleagues have written a recent article in the journal Mathematical Thinking and Learning. This was with Amy Roth McDuffie, Corey Drake, and John Davis. And they had an article entitled, The Role of Instructional Materials in the Relationship Between the Official Curriculum and the Enacted Curriculum. And that's in MTL. And Jeff, I know you've been doing some work, and I've been reading some of your work and citing it related to mathematics curriculum. I wonder if you want to just get us up to speed a little bit about how you got to this article. So what was some of that prior work you did and some of the ideas you've been exploring around math curriculum, and how has that sort of started to lead you to this study?
Sure. First of all, I want to thank the other members of the team on that article. Amy, Corey, and John are truly amazing colleagues, and it was great to work with them. And I couldn't ask for a better group of people to think with.
Yeah, they're awesome.
So I had a career grant. I would say that's sort of where this work started. Well, my dissertation work was on discourse, so I sort of got interested into how teachers mainly organize classroom discourse and how to help students' thinking become sort of an object of discussion. So that was a starting point. And my dissertation did take place in CMP classrooms. And I came to Rochester, and there was a whole group of people who were really implementing it. And we have a Center for Professional Development, and they were pushing the curriculum and support for it out there. So I decided to get the career grant on how teachers use and learn from what I called at the time innovative curriculum materials, which I, you know, this article would now would say thinking device materials. It kind of alerted me to a few things in terms of both teaching and design a curriculum. But this notion of pulling ideas out on the table and then having multiple activities where students could play around with these ideas and then essentially or eventually refine them into more formal and conventional thinking, and also typically more abstract and algebraic forms, that really got my imagination. And I also happened to be in a few teachers' classrooms who were very good at really building off of student thinking. And so watching, allowing students to use informal terminology and then build up and then name things over time, that was sort of an insight to me. I hadn't really seen that before. And then the other focus with that was on looking at instructional sequences as units of study rather than just tasks. You know, with the task framework at a Quasar, people focused a lot on qualities of tasks, and there was a lot less attention paid to how these things are put together and how those sequences build meaning over time. So that was the lead up to that. And John Davis and I got into conversations around pedagogical design capacity. And then I, you know, got into other conversations with Corey and Amy around curriculum. And that's sort of where the grant, the Ergo grant, originated.
So you mentioned the thinking device. And I know in math education, there's been a long time conversations about traditional curricula, whatever that means, or traditional textbooks, and then, you know, reform textbooks, reform curricula, innovative curricula, problem-based, like there's all these different terms. In this article, you sort of ended up with these categories. They don't just describe the historical context of being innovative or traditional, or they don't, you know, define it based on how it relates to things before, but you have delivery mechanism, and then you have thinking device as a way to talk about what you find in curriculum materials. Can you say a little bit about those two terms and how they came to be the terms you use in this paper?
Sure. Well, first of all, we wanted to avoid using terms like traditional and reform because they didn't really serve a good purpose, and they didn't really describe the materials. And I also think there was an implicit negativity around the word traditional. And we were trying to avoid all that by coming off of the assumption that everybody has a goal of rigorous math learning, regardless of the design of curriculum. Nobody puts out a curriculum where they don't want students to learn. So that was the starting point. You know, we landed on this idea of communicative function as a means of describing how curricula design differ. Monologic and dialogic. Monologic is the idea of disseminating knowledge or information, and it's the conduit device, you know, so that it's, you know, information flows, people either interpret it or encode it or decode it or whatever. If there's a problem, it's a transmission error. That's the sort of analogy. And that also associates with people packaging curricula according to the organization of the discipline. This is, you know, expert knowledge, expert practice. We're going to break it down and be able to deliver it to somebody who can then pick it up just as it is and become themselves expert in the domain. So that's the rationale. And that was the scientific rational approach to curriculum development. And that's sort of historically the prevalent form, in part because it privileges people who have these strong disciplinary backgrounds and who feel like they can teach others via their own perspective on the discipline. And we sort of know that has some benefits and some downsides. Dialogic is the other communication function. And that assumes that knowledge isn't fixed or can be transmitted, but that it's negotiated in a group of people, and that it's talking about objects that is how people come to learn, not just sort of being exposed to them. And they mapped really well to existing designs. I'd say the most conventionally designed curricula done by commercial entities tend to be delivery mechanism. And then the thinking device ones tended more or less to come out of the NSF funding, in part because they were explicitly building off of 50 years of research in cognitive and sociocultural research, which privileged the social nature of learning. And so, you know, no surprise that they would be a little more along the lines of a thinking device approach to, you know, getting ideas out on the table, kind of kicking up the dust and seeing what happens, and then using those ideas to, you know, map to big mathematical ideas.
Yeah, great. So we have these thoughts about the instructional materials in math. And then in the article in Mathematical Thinking and Learning, you also are looking at official curriculum and operational curriculum, or the enacted curriculum. So what was your main purpose for this study? How were you trying to get into that mess of those different types of curriculum and the materials themselves?
Well, we were funded in part because we directly explored the impact of the Common Core. So that was the context or subtext of the study, was that we got funded literally as that was coming out. And of course, by the end of the grant, it was, you know, most states had already said, well, we don't want the Common Core. But it was an innovative and I think unique for the U.S. approach to trying to get most people on the same page with a set of standards that, you know, aligned with international standards, if you want to call it that. And those are sort of generous descriptions, certainly reflects the logic of the Common Core. And you can quibble about whether it actually were those things, the Common Core, you know, but nevertheless, it was a rather big policy move at the time. And so there's a logic there that you can dictate or control or influence what goes on in math classrooms by altering standards. And so we were testing that. And there were two sort of levels of official curriculum we were testing, which is just the articulation of the standards. And then the other piece was, well, and districts would adopt materials to, they say, we're aligned with the standards. And then that was another piece of the official curriculum. And we were testing the hypothesis of which of those things really, you know, impact. And we did surveys amongst all of our teachers and found that regardless of the materials they were using, they had very similar visions of the Common Core. And so any differences that we would see, we could more or less attribute to the materials that they adopted, because they all felt the same way. This was going to promote active student participation, lots of problem solving, high levels of complexity, that kind of thing. And then, of course, we saw some pretty stark differences between the materials defined as delivery mechanism and those aligned with the thinking device approach.
Okay, great. So you're looking at some middle grades math teachers, they're enacting lessons, you're looking at the materials they're using, and you ask questions about what does the rigor of mathematics look like? Again, trying to give both sides credit for their trying to achieve mathematical rigor, but it might come in different forms or it might take different shapes. And then you have this question about what's the role of the instructional materials in the relationship between official curriculum and operational curriculum. So could you just give us the quick overview of your data and then how you analyze that? And again, I always think it's better for the listeners if they go to the article, see the details as printed in the journal. But if you can give us enough of a sense of that data and analysis that we can follow along with you into your findings.
Sure. So there is a table in the article. There's two tables, one of which gets at the characteristics of curriculum materials. So then the four of us would go, and I think we all four looked at all the, there were seven sets, and we looked at, I forget what percent, how many lessons per, but enough that we felt like, okay, you know, looking at another lesson wasn't going to change our minds. And we had, you know, a pretty fair divide. We had a lot of twos in that scale, which meant they were strongly oriented towards a delivery mechanism. And then we had a two that were on the other, on the thinking device side. That was a CMP, a little more, we felt was a little more open. CPM also was thinking device, but a little more structured and scaffolded. So we gave it a slightly less lower rating. So we did a whole, we looked at those characteristics, applied them to the materials, came out with those ratings. And then the other thing we did was look at what we called mathematical activity. There are a lot of ways of analyzing both tasks and lessons. Don't ask me why we wanted to come up with our own, but we did. But I think it the rigor, the definitions of rigor and the distinctions of those definitions or those classifications amongst different types of mathematical activity is, I think, a contribution the field should be paying attention to, because we've got this cognitive demand framework, which has been super helpful, but it essentially makes a distinction between tasks that have connections, you know, that connect to concepts, and those that don't, that are highly procedural. There's not really a lot of nuance there, and it doesn't make any nuance between different mathematical topics, and it doesn't give you a sense of different ways, different kinds of connections that could be made. So we studied the Common Core materials and looked at, and we didn't want to call something non-rigorous because we didn't think that was fair. You know, everything you can do could be claimed to have some form of rigor. But we decided the distinction would be routineness. So things that are, you know, a lot, practicing a procedure, it can be rigorous, but it's routine. Whereas, you know, this strategically deciding which type of procedure to apply, or applying something in a new context, or developing reasoning around terminology or whatever, those were different forms of rigor. And we have those mapped out by mathematical domains. There are other forms of activity that could be on that list, like number and proof. They're not there because we were studying middle school, and we're trying to limit which topics were represented in the lessons, but those could be there as well. So we chunked the videos into 5-minute chunks and coded for those different forms of rigor and activity within the 5-minute chunks. And the kind of mathematical activity was more or less dictated by the topic. So that was sort of like, once that was decided at the beginning, it wasn't going to change. Whereas the forms of rigor within the lesson could change over the course of a lesson.
Right. And the different forms of rigor, what ends up becoming kind of important is this difference between procedural skill, and that's a form of rigor. So you're not trying to discount it, but you are trying to characterize it as procedural skill kind of work for that 5-minute segment is different. And then you have these other ones that you ended up sort of grouping together. That was the fluency, application, or concept development, or like conceptual understanding. And those ones, again, they kind of, like you were saying here, the fluency, application, and the conceptual side, those are non-routine, or they're less routine than the procedural practice.
Correct.
But they all are different forms of rigor. So I kind of appreciated that you're not trying to play this rigor versus non-rigor game, which you hear a lot in the public discourse about this.
And the idea of conceptual understanding as being the alternative to non-conceptual, that turned out not to, I mean, we had other ways that were important forms of reasoning, like procedural fluency, where you're figuring out, you know, different, how to apply a procedure or which one to apply in a given context. It's a little different than building a concept. That was one that we looked a lot all over the literature to get a strong definition for conceptual understanding. And it is one of those terms that's talked about a lot, but there's not a lot of really fine grained definitions. So that was the other reason to split up the forms of non-routine rigor.
Right. And then the teachers I noticed too were from several different states. So you're kind of getting different state curriculum contexts, right? Like I know there was Michigan, New York in there, some others.
There was, like 7 or 8 states, I think. Yeah.
Okay. Great. So if we go into some of your findings, I mean, to me, it struck me that you did find some overall trends. There were some relationships between the instructional materials, the thinking device kind of materials, or the delivery mechanism kind of materials. Those did relate to some of what you saw in the class period. But what I thought was interesting was whenever you had a main finding, you also had some caveats to it, or you had some counterexamples. Like you had, so it's not a perfect mapping of what people might expect of, oh, thinking device textbook, you're always going to have these conceptual applications all the time. There was more nuance to each one of your major findings. I hope I characterized that okay, but I'll let you say more about what were some of those overall findings, but then how did you have the counterexamples or the nuance to each of them?
Sure. Well, the one finding that didn't make it in the paper because it wasn't part of the Common Core that I did want to highlight was we did look at the discourse to see how much of it was focused on the teacher versus the student, you know, and the for the delivery mechanism materials, it was exclusively teacher-centric or teacher-controlled discourse, and there was a wide variation amongst that. It didn't, and we ended up having to take that out, but it always struck me as, you know, if you want students to talk, you have to give them something to talk about, and that you'll find more of that in the thinking device material. So that was one trend. So if we start with the delivery mechanism materials, majority of them were exclusively or heavily procedurally, you know, the routine forms of procedure. And so that was, I'd say, a pretty important findings, given that the Common Core was pretty clear. That's not all. It's not bad to have some of that, but it shouldn't be where you spend most or all of your time. And that was the case in the delivery mechanism classrooms. There were some exceptions. One of the curricula, the one, the Singapore math, they had another word for it, math and focus, we mentioned in the paper, had some characteristics that were quite different than the Glencoe and the other one that were the other ones that were listed as delivery mechanism. But, you know, we were studying communication functions, so they've all got it too. But it did come up in the findings of different, you know, routine and non-routine forms is that the math and focus were a little more oriented or a little more likely to have non-routine or balance of those two. Whereas the other kinds were much of delivery mechanism, much more likely to just procedure. And we found variation, not surprisingly, amongst the thinking device. And that's, you know, for a whole host of reasons, not the least of which was they were very uneven in terms of the teachers, in terms of their preparation. One district in particular, they had just gotten it. It had been rolled out. It was a large district. They hadn't had a lot of time for professional development yet. And other districts that we were focused on had, you know, decades of experience with these kinds of curricula. So we saw that was, and we didn't have a chance to really explore sort of why there was this variation. But I'd say, you know, anecdotally, the support given to the teachers that were using them in ways that were had a lot of non-routine forms of activity were different than those places where they had more routine forms of rigor.
Yeah. And so you're alluding to that diversity of what you saw with the thinking device materials, like the teachers implementing the thinking device materials. Right. And so sometimes there still was a gravitation towards procedural, at least in some lessons, sure. There was still a Absolutely. Gravitation towards procedural yeah. kinds of exercises, even with a thinking device textbook. Is that what I'm hearing?
I agree right? with
in,
that.
In, yes. some, in some cases.
It's not a guarantee.
Having the thinking device material does not guarantee that you're spending a lot of your time in the applications and the conceptual development.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, you did in the article, you presented the straight findings from your analysis, but then you did start to, with your co-authors, talk about some other factors that were at play. And of course, each of these factors could kind of become a study on its own. But I wondered if you could just comment on a few of those other factors that you feel like are definitely at play in this mix. You know, even though you're analyzing aspects of the curriculum, other stuff is always peering its head in, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I just alluded to one, which was, you know, some people were in districts that had long-term use and support for the use of more challenge. And I would say thinking device, without much argument, people would say is more challenging to use in a way that promotes non-routine forms of rigor. There's all sorts of uncertainty, you know, the teacher authority is, you know, now a mix between teacher and student authority. So there's just so many reasons why these things, you know, the high stakes testing, people beholden to that and feel like they have to kind of blow through curriculum to get people prepared. So Remillard talks about the participatory relationship between curriculum and teacher. And for the most part in the literature, it's always been the teacher characteristics influencing what happens, you know, with the implementation or enactment of curriculum. And we were kind of pushing in the other direction, which is we're arguing the curriculum characteristics have an influence on how on the mathematical activity. It isn't just the teacher who decides or who influences this, that you can put this in the hands of a lot of teachers. And overall, you're going to get a different kind of mathematical activity than if you were to give the same set of teachers a delivery mechanism. We didn't get to test that, obviously, in that sort of controlled way, but I think that's a pretty, given the size of our sample and the variety of our sample, both in teacher experience and geographic locations, I think that's a fair claim. And so we were pushing hard the other way, and we did get a pushback from an editor who ultimately did not accept this paper. And because that editor wanted to really get more about the qualities of the teachers in the sample, and we didn't have the space for it, but it also wasn't our focus. So that was a little bit intentional.
Yeah, you're trying to put the materials in the spotlight, just not because it's the only thing, but just because sometimes it deserves to be in the spotlight.
I felt like it was a different study if we'd gone and suddenly started looking at the teacher characteristics and how, and because that's been done a lot. This hadn't.
Right. The teacher characteristics are very important, but also have been studied by a lot of people. And to me, it also makes me think about your other work about the teacher learning from the curriculum, you know, over time, having multiple iterations with it. So that's another way in which the curriculum is kind of shaping the teacher. It's not just the teacher using the curriculum and making the decisions. The curriculum kind of is also pushing back a little bit, or it's a relationship between the two.
Yeah. Having said that, I, you know, in my career, grant, I had a dozen teachers in the study, and there were two or three who really, you know, understood this idea of development over time and instructional sequence. And the other ones were less sort of onto that. And they did use the curriculum, I think, in a less productive way than those who were like, the students can come up with this, their thinking can drive this conversation. So there were in that study, you know, I was pretty aware also that teacher characteristics obviously matter. And I don't want to dismiss that side of things.
Agreed. So just to kind of wrap up the article, I have just one question kind of about the instructional materials. And then I have a kind of a step back question about the curriculum and the standards. So on the instructional materials, if somebody read this study and they just took away a very simple thing, which is like the delivery mechanism materials related to procedural emphasis in class and thinking device materials related with fluency, application, conceptual development in class. If somebody stepped away with that sort of simplistic kind of takeaway, how would you feel about it? What would you want to say to that person?
You know, as you were saying that, what crossed my mind was like, everything depends on what your goals are. So if your goals are you want students to develop procedural, you know, automaticity, then the delivery mechanism materials are fantastic materials. And if your goal is to have students get into conversations around topics that are not 100% decided for them in advance of them talking about it, then you have to go with the thinking device materials. And you have to be willing to accept the messiness and the uncertainty, but also embrace the richness. So your goals matter a lot. And I think that's part of what we were also, you know, one of the things that drove me in this study was there's no way of evaluating whether something's good or bad until you decide what your goals are for using it. And that's where the Common Core, people's initial thoughts were, this opens up the space for me to really challenge my students and give them some rich activities and rich things to do. What was unfortunate was the high stakes testing sort of closed that window really fast. And so, you know, in the end, I think you would see, and I'm going to talk now about the Common Core, you know, it didn't really have much lasting impact because it was tied to high stakes testing. And in the end, that's what people paid attention to. In addition to, obviously, in terms of the inactive lessons, they paid attention to what was put in front of them by their districts saying, this is what you have to teach. And in the high stakes environment, you pretty much do what you're asked to do in that regard. So I would say question your goals and be true to them. And hopefully you'll feel ambitious and want your students to get into interesting conversations whose outcome is not always clear during the moment or after the moment.
So then that leads right to then stepping back, because you're talking about Common Core and talking about goals. I mean, in one sense, the standards that we set at the state level are the goals for math education that we have you know, as a society, we've elected people and they've been put into positions to set these standards. So in a sense, that's like society saying, here are our goals for math education. So that's in the official curriculum. But stepping back, though, to that sort of level, what insights do you feel like you've gotten from this study as it relates to the official curriculum and then how that plays out with the operational curriculum?
I would say if you're a policymaker and your goal is to dictate classroom practice, just defining or adopting a set of standards is not going to do it for you. The Common Core authors were intentionally agnostic with respect to curriculum and instructional approaches. And I think they did that for a couple of reasons. They didn't want to step on anybody's toes with in terms of a federal influence on local policy. Mm-hmm. And then the other one was, I think they were all believers that if you articulate mathematics in a very orderly way, in a very clear way, that people will learn. And, you know, that's been tested from the new math era on and found to be wanting. And that's who wrote the standards for the most part, were mathematicians. And I'm sure there are a fine set of standards, but they're not going to push people to learn the kind of math that you want them to. It does boil down to the things that they're sitting in front of them and in front of teachers are the things that greatly influence the kinds of mathematical activity in which students engage. So one insight for policymakers is you're going to have to place your bet somewhere and piss people off if you want to, you know, like, yeah, these are the curriculum materials that are going to get you where you want to go if your goal is to get students to think for themselves. But, you know, in the current climate, I don't think we're going to see much of that. Mm-hmm. And it's much easier to sit back and adopt a set of standards and then claim you're holding people accountable for enacting them, whether that makes sense or not.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Jeff Chopin from the Warner School of Education at the University of Rochester. And Jeff, you've been on the podcast before as part of a team we did a few years ago, but I haven't had you as a solo guest on the podcast before. So I do want to ask you a couple of these questions to just help put people on the map. So where did you do your grad studies and what was the focus of your dissertation? You actually alluded to it earlier, but maybe you could say a little bit more back into your grad school days.
Yeah, sure. I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Now it's been 20 years plus. Really, really great place to go to grad school for so many different reasons. There was a great group of math educators, including my major professor, Eric Knuth, who's now at NSF. Really great guy to work with and just great human being all around. But there was also, at the time, Tom Carpenter, Tom Romberg, Liz Fenema, Bill Tate was there, Walter Sakata. There were just some really big brains and interesting, fun people walking around the hallways. And that was just on the math ed side. There was also the, you know, Gloria Latson-Billings, Michael Apple, Jim G. You know, these were just fabulous people to, and I'd been teaching for 12 years. So I was like a kid in a candy shop. So it was a lot of fun. And I did my dissertation was on classroom discourse, and it ended up, you know, morphing into being, you know, in the dissertation afterwards, how teachers navigated what they did with student solutions and how they got those, make those objects of public discourse, I would say, is the short take on that.
Mm-hmm. Maybe they're taking some student solutions and making them thinking devices instead of just delivering.
That's kind of where, I mean, that was a direct line there of thinking. And it's funny because when I was in grad school, I would do this journal. And I kept thinking I'm changing my mind all the time. But then I'd go back and read journals from like 3 years before and a surprisingly stable thought. And I think that's one of the thoughts that ended up being quite stable over time.
Mm-hmm. Now, what though, if you had given up and just went a totally different way? What if you weren't in math education? Could you have imagined doing something else as an alternative career?
Goodness. Yeah, I saw that question. I can imagine what I would have done before I got into it, before I got into teaching. I was an economics major at University of Notre Dame, and they had a really big group of people there doing development economics, so sort of economics of third world countries. And, you know, one of the ideas that I always had, like if I had stayed in there, I wouldn't have been the econometrician, but I've always been interested in looking at how investing or spending in local businesses, what that does in terms of the, you know, the cycle of cash in the community versus investing, say, in multinational corporations. Like, where does the money go? How much sticks around? How does that, you know, multiply within the community if you decide to spend local? So I think that would have been my object of study. I don't know if I'd have made any money at it, but.
But you would at least know where your money went
Exactly.
when it left your hand. No, that's definitely interesting, important stuff as well. But yeah, Jeff, it's been great talking to you, and I always appreciate reading your work. You're one of the folks where when you have studies come out, I usually grab it from my Google Alerts and download it right away.
Nice. Well, thank
was
you. Yeah.
Definitely glad to hear some of the insights behind the thinking on this piece, and thanks for sharing it with us.
Yeah, thank you, Sam. You're an amazing colleague, and I've been lucky to know you for a long time.
Well, that's very sweet. Normally, I interview a math ed scholar about their research, but there were some episodes we did a few years ago that were called digest episodes. Those episodes included multiple short summaries of new research articles in math education, and so it was kind of like a reader's digest where you could use the digest episode to efficiently get a glimpse across various ideas and studies that are out there, because we know it's hard to keep up with all of it. I'd like to bring back some digest episodes, but I want to try crowdsourcing it. I'm curious about what you are reading. What studies have caught your attention, or if there's a book or a project that more people should hear about in math education. It could be something brand new, or it could be something from the past, but it's new to you and worth sharing. It could even be your own work that you want to summarize and share in the podcast feed. So this is an open call for short submissions to future digest episodes on the Math Ed podcast. What I'm looking for are audio files that are about 3 to 6 minutes in duration. I'll collect them and then periodically release them in groups to make digest episodes. If you have something to summarize and share, please find a quiet place and record yourself giving the summary. Aim for about 3 to 6 minutes and then send the audio file to ottensam@att.net. And please put Math Ed Digest in the subject line. That's ottensam@att.net. Within your audio recording, I just ask that you officially introduce yourself, and then also give full credit to all of the co-authors involved in the work. But it's totally fine to summarize the work in your own words, and you can talk about why it's meaningful to you personally. I'll take care of all the approvals and getting it ready for publication on the Math Ed podcast.